discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion passes. We're going to move right into our business. I just so that everybody knows that about 10 to 12, some of us are involved in a press conference, and we're going to stop at 10 to 12. So I hope we don't have somebody in the middle of their report at that time, but we'll do the best we can. So with that, we've been in long waiting for this, so we're going to have the report. I'll have to say that the flu is going around, and some of us have had it, and we're getting over it. And Niles, we appreciate you sucking it up and getting in here today and doing this. So go ahead and tell us what we...
Okay, so I will be going when you ask questions.
Yeah.
There it is. I will get going if we get to the questions parts, and I have to think slow. I'm thinking slow. So we'll get it to go.
Understandable.
All right. We are on the phase four report out of the study, which is the last phase. And the phase four had three principal goals, which was basically to finalize the data, finalize the report, and make a presentation. So that's what I'll attempt to do today. There's some trends that we base much of what we're talking on today, much in the report on, and I'm just going to talk about those a little bit. We believe strongly that the drilling levels will be stable over the next five-year study period. That belief comes from the fact that drilling costs are going down or stabilized, and that we've moved to drilling in very intense, highly productive areas. And I'll talk a little about that as we move into the slide. The next bullet is a major change from our previous presentations. And previously, we believed that the production in the Bakken would be capped by finance and a number of other characteristics at 1.4 to 1.7 million barrels per day. Looking at the new information that has come in the last 3-4 months, we believe that production in the Bakken in the next 5 years could grow to as high as 2 million barrels per day. And that's based on based on a lot of things, but an easy characteristic that we can look at is that on average for the last 18 months we brought online about 18,000 barrels a day, barrels a month of oil. And so if we, and that 18,000 barrels a month of oil that we brought on is averaged, of course, over those 18 months, but it looks sustainable. So if we continue to drill the same number of holes, and the depletion rates continue at the rates that they're occurring, which is less than what the industry and we had expected, and we can continue to add 18,000 net barrels per month to production, we'll be at over 2 million barrels per day in 2019. So there's a big difference there, and that is that the infrastructure needs to be designed for the 2 million barrel number, which is a much higher number. We can't see anything that suggests that oil prices will not operate within the range shown. And the range is $70 to $100 per barrel. And that's, and again, that's from industry reviews. There's always unforeseen circumstances that can make oil prices drop, and oftentimes it has no basis or understanding as to why it's dropping, it just does. The difference is that, however, I want to note that just because Brent is selling for $70 to $100 per barrel, the big variable in Bakken crude is what we get paid at the wellhead. And so the wellhead cost is about $10 to $12 less than what the posted price is. And so that could drop below the 70. The 70 is the threshold for oil in national or international levels, and then we've got some deficits we pay for being so landlocked with our crude. And as an example, when we compete against the Eagle Ford looks at its oil and says we take a $5 deficit at the wellhead. And we look at our Bakken crude and we say we take a $12 to $15 deficit at the wellhead based upon our transportation costs and all of those extra things that it takes to get to market. Because market still only pays the posted price at the international level. It is looking like U.S. shale oil will compete in the markets very well. There's interesting things happening right now with crude being shipped into Canada and being barged down the coast in exchange for heavy crudes. There's just a lot of things happening where the markets are adjusting. I think in the next 5 years, you're going to see a lot of pipeline direction changes. You're going to see shipping methods and channels change. You're going to see delivery methods to refineries adjust. But the most important thing is that the industry is absorbing the shale oil. And they're taking it in, and it's a better oil in most cases anyway, but they're taking it in and taking advantage of its very profitable nature. And then at the next level, global needs will absorb the U.S. shale oil too. Refiners are finally up to speed on what can be produced, and they know how to treat our shales, and they're proving to be highly profitable. So if we get the ability to export, we will see substantial changes in our markets. So those are the trends that we believed and acted on as we moved forward. And I'm going to just go through a lot of these quickly. You've seen most of these, but I just want to use these for background. And so we're showing on this particular slide the three most important boundaries. And the first boundary, the blue boundary, is the boundary for where the Bakken is thermally mature. The second boundary is the boundary where we have one level of Three Forks, the red boundary. And then the yellow boundary is where we have multiple levels of Three Forks that we can drill out of. And this is very important because the greater quantities of recoverable oil will be delivered from those areas that are circled inside the yellow circle. The second greatest quantities will come from the red circles, and then the Bakken itself will deliver out of the blue. And as an example, we forecasted originally, and many, when we looked at the fact that there would be multiple wells on pads, many of us felt that there would be 4 to 6 wells, and in fact, when we did the electrical study, we said that there would be up to 6 wells per pad, which we thought was a very big stretch. Well, inside the blue, that's true. Inside the red, that's not so true. And inside the yellow, it's completely incorrect. Inside the yellow, we could see as many as 24 wells servicing an individual spacing unit. And so that's a significant change. So you can see with this slide where the infrastructure needs will be focused and where most of our oil will come from in the long term. And more importantly, where the most profitable oil will come from. Because as we move into multiple well pads and we go into these high flow concentration areas, it's more profitable to harvest that oil. This is, again, just for background, because we often look at these. And for me, it's very surprising because, again, I go back to my first oil boom in the 80s. And if we hit a 500 barrel per day well, it was a pretty big deal. And now we're looking and saying 750 barrels a day IP, you know, that's got at $85 a barrel, which is about what we're getting today at the wellhead. So at the wellhead would be $85 to $89 today. Well, at that rate, it takes, at a 750 barrel per day well, it takes 36 months before it pays back. And remember that these wells decrease and deplete quickly. So 50% of the depletion occurs around 50%, 40 to 50 in the first year, and then it continues to decline at that rapid rate. And these curves take that into consideration. Now the good news is that we're finding that the Bakken wells tend to produce longer than expected, so the depletion curves are being extended outward, which helps us in the long run because we're not having to replace all of that oil to keep our production up because they're not depleting at the rates need to be. But again, if you take out a good well, which is a 3,000 barrel per day IP well, we're looking at paybacks within the first 3 to 6 months. So in those areas where we showed the circles, and I'll get to the next one too that shows it better, those are closer to 2,000 barrel per day IP wells. So if you go to the next slide and you look at this graph, this is the visual graph of where the most profitable regions to harvest oil and gas from our Bakken is. In those areas in red are where you're going to find that we have the most concentrated, highly productive areas. And as the colors tone down, on the bottom you can see it goes yellow, orange, I mean, red, orange, yellow, light blue, dark blue. And the dark blue are still profitable, it's just that they're at the rates we talked about. They're closer to the 750 barrel per day IPs, and the reds are the ones that are closer to the 3,000. What's also interesting about it, and I'm sorry it's not on here, but if you put that red or that yellow line from the previous graph on, you'll find that a lot of the highly productive red zones where production is highest also include multiple platforms that we're drilling off of. So it compounds it. Now, the significance of this, I want just to note before we move forward, is that where the red areas are, is where the infrastructure needs are most concentrated. Those are the areas where we have to have the largest sized gathering systems. It's the area where we have to have, there'll be more traffic coming onto the well sites because there'll be more wells and they're highly productive, so you can't let them go down. So the red zones are going to be where infrastructure at the local transportation network side needs to go towards. And then as you decrease into the blues, you'll be looking more at lower infrastructure demands. And I'll refer back to this graph as we get into the infrastructure needs analysis. This graph shows the population growth potential. And
just a second now, Senator Anders.
Mr. Chairman, regarding who's going to be, can we ask questions as we go?
I'm fine with that.
All right,
I found this payback chart really interesting. I was wondering if that's a payback of the drilling costs or if it's a payback of all the extraneous costs as well, the leasing and that kind of thing.
It is a payback, Senator, of the on-pad costs. So it's the lease costs, it's the development, all development costs on pad. It does not include payback of the gathering systems, which are separate, but and have longer payback periods in all cases. But it is all costs on pad.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay. Continue.
Mr. Chairman,
you have another one?
Another question, yeah. In this chart, which shows the high production areas, is that a moving target, or is that pretty well defined now?
You know, we started looking at this statistic about a year ago and started analyzing it and started coloring the areas in to see how consistent it would remain. And at the scale it's shown, it's consistent. Now, the boundaries are moving in and out by a mile or two or three, which doesn't affect at this scale, but generally speaking, for the last year, continuing to take in all of the publicly available data, the map has not changed much. So it is very consistent. And I do want to point out another thing, and I'm sorry for jumping back and forth, but you reminded me of another statistic. Remember, last time we talked about the fact that drilling on federal lands in North Dakota just doesn't really happen. So if you look down in the corner, on the left-hand side where it says Billings, and that's Billings County, actually, but that's where the national parks are and the grasslands. So if, for instance, something changed at the federal level which would allow for us to access that area, we believe it has high potential for development, but until something changes, we won't be able to tackle it. That would make for a major adjustment in the map. But other than that, the outside perimeter boundaries seem to be very well established, and actually the boundaries for instance, the highly productive zones in red seem to be pretty well stationary. Okay, I'll move now into the next slide, which is population growth potential. Nancy and Dean are here today with NDSU. And they provided all of the population growth information for us, including housing. Boy, you talk about a moving target. Over the past 5 years, their task has been enormous. They've done a great job of modeling this, and I think that compliment them on the fact that they have great algorithms now and models that actually work, so that I think for the first time we can feel fairly confident in these projections as to what our population growth will look like. The legend in this case is colored towards the total percentage of population growth. And the counties that are in the dark burgundy are those with the highest percentage of population growth. And in those counties will be 25 to 35%, and then as you drop to the cooler colors into the yellows, you'll find that that drops down into the 5% range. So we're looking, as we would expect, that the greatest percentage of population percentage gain comes in the counties that go right through the center of the growth. Also, please keep in mind, and we have other graphs and charts that will show you more, but this is as a percentage of existing population by county, so the smaller counties don't have to grow much to get a 35% growth in population. But it still reflects the level of impact that comes to those counties, because a 25 to 32% increase in population growth requires significant infrastructure adjustments. Employment projections. Again, this material was provided to us by Dean and Nancy from NDSU, and it talks about, shows you where we believe the study period looks for total population growth and population employment growth. Employment growth is an extremely important characteristic, and I'll use this opportunity to talk and give you an in-case real example of what we see is a critical disenabler that might occur. And that is, in my Williston office, when I was up there a couple weeks ago, we have 35 employees. And I asked, how many of you plan to be here in 5 years? And not a single person raised their hand. And so, which is so different than for us. And so I said, how many people plan on being here in 2 years? Maybe 3, 4 raised their hands. So those type of attrition rates are what we're starting to experience internally at KLJ, and which the industry is starting to experience. And that's a very powerful, possible restrictor for the growth that we have coming on. And of course, we're all looking at ways to do our jobs better with less people, try to figure out how to automate, how to bring on new technologies and do things, but it doesn't matter. When a valve goes out on a pipeline, you still need somebody to go out there and turn the valve and figure out what's wrong with it. You can't use a machine to do it. So employment is going to be very important for us as a state, how we get them, how we attract them. There's another employment dynamic that
I'll... Before you go on to that, Senator Armstrong has a question.
Yeah, I just have a quick question, Mr. Chairman, on the population growth potential. When did you... Is this moving forward from essentially today's date?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. Thank you.
So this is after the previous growth?
Right. This is post-growth to date. And another, again, trend in the employment industry that I can't put my finger on, but I can tell you because I'm personally involved in it, that's going to affect us significantly, and that is the churn that's going on. So in our oil and gas business, we will go out and recruit like crazy to try to find pipeline engineers. So I'll bring a pipeline engineer on and pay that person, let's just say it's a senior pipeline engineer. So I'd be, a reasonable salary would be around $120,000 a year. So I'll bring that person on, move him up from Houston, and in 6 months, he'll come to my office and he'll say, I just got an offer from XYZ company. They're going to pay me 20% more and I get a signing bonus. Okay, so now his salary is up to $144,000, maybe $145,000. Well, then I'm going to look and say, well, then I got to go recruit somebody. So I go recruit out of some other company, and I got to pay him a signing bonus, and I got to pay him $144 plus to get him. So the salaries for highly skilled people with your oil field experience, either management or operations, are going up so fast through employee churn that there's going to be a point where that threshold is going to cause some reserve in those of us that have to hire and those that are developing in the field. So those two employment trends suggest that we're going to have to do a lot extra to meet those rapid growth curves and bring in another 60,000 employees over the next 5 years to staff the jobs that we need to have. So now I'll just touch a little bit on the final regional housing needs. And you can see that these things present three scenarios, low, medium, and high. So I'll focus on the medium, which we believe is in the middle. So, and I'll just touch on these and then go back and show you what the significance of these is for infrastructure. So from 2014 to 2019, we're predicting in Williston that we will be adding around 16,000 new residential units to try to take care of the employees that will flow into that particular region. And note in the bottom that at the conclusion, before I get to the next slide, that Williston will have around 58,000 on that scenario, 58,000 housing units that could be in place. So now I'm going to go to, Minot and say, okay, so Minot's going to grow by about 6,000. But Williston is going to be darn near the size of Minot. And so that's a significant adjustment, because Minot spent the last 50 years figuring out how to be the size of Minot. And Williston's trying to figure out how to be the size of Williston in 5 years. It takes significant adjustments in operations practices and policies, just a lot of things. And so so that to me is a very significant adjustment and change in what's going on. And then the last region that we surveyed is Dickinson, and Dickinson will grow by about 10,000 housing units in that same period of time. And this is just the study period, 2014 to 2019. And the other statistic that I'll note is that it's all housing. It's temporary, it's permanent, it's apartments, it's everything, all in one. And we were asked to touch on this, so I'm just going to touch on it a little bit in the closing, and then move on to the infrastructure trends that we see. CO2 enhanced oil recovery was a topic that was brought up along with other ones. At the last meeting, we reported that we saw better chances for methane-based enhanced oil recovery. We still do. However, along the pipeline route, the DGC CO2 line, there is potential for enhanced recovery. And those are in the green areas that we see. Those are fields that could actually benefit from enhanced oil recovery, but as you can see by the scale, it's not significant. So if we did see enhanced oil recovery within the next 5 years, it would be a very small contribution to our overall production. Okay, so we were asked to look at and point out technology, process, and environmental changes that could affect infrastructure in the Bakken in 2014 to 2019. So what I've moved it as is that infrastructure needs are based on production. So these are things that will affect production in the 2014 to 2019 window. Mm-hmm. And the first one is what I label three-dimensional field development. And what that means is that instead of when we originally thought we'd put way back in 2009, we'd put one horizontal leg up the middle of a spacing unit and hit very good and think we were doing well. Okay, that was two-dimensional thinking. So now we've gone in and we've said, first of all, there's three platforms we can harvest out of, upper Three Forks, lower Three Forks, and Bakken itself. But more importantly, we can stagger the spacings. So now the development in any given field is done in a three-dimensional form. So they put the laterals across the field in ways that go through the best production areas. They frack to exactly the right dimensions so that those laterals they see some interaction, but they don't break through. And so the field now is being developed in three dimensions, which is a significant change, and that change will go on. And we still aren't completely sure how the fracking patterns are working. I mean, if they're actually working the way they're supposed to, but over the next 5 years, that will change, and there will be a significant improvements in overall field production, and more importantly, the depletion curve should extend outward as this process gets better. And it's on a very rapid growth potential curve now, so it should continue. Batch development. We talked about that last time, where we talked about the fact that now instead of drilling a single well on a single pad, explorers are coming in and the companies are coming in and they're saying, let's drill out the Bakken. So they'll go into to the pad and it'll take 8 wells to drill out the Bakken. Well, they'll drill them out 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Drill the upper piece off, cap it off, change the tools out, drill down to where we make the horizontal swing. But anyways, go through all four phases, optimizing cost, but drilling 8 of them at a time. That's what the batch drilling process. Batch fracking process means we come on with a fracking crew, and the fracking crew stays there until they developed out all 8 of the holes. And that's a big change, big difference, big cost adjustment, but has a lot of other implications because of the things you can do when you're able to influence and monitor multiple holes at the same time that you're fracking them. So that's an infancy stage. The first time that they did batch processing, batch fracking, batch drilling was in December and January. So I mean, it's in the infancy stages. There's a rapid growth curve that's going to follow. It's going to make it different. Now, what happened was...
Before you move on, Representative Porter?
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Hushka, inside of the batch development fund, is there, from start to finish, since they're doing each of the four phases separately, how much lag time is there for the infrastructure development, for the pipelines, and for the interconnection into the rest of the system?
Representative Porter, I think that you're pointing out a significant change from the past. The past, the way the field would develop is that the rig would move on site, drill the hole, they'd call the frac company, and at the same time they'd call the gathering system guy. Say, oh man, I forgot. We need a gas line. We're going to be producing gas in a while. Now what happens is that the companies are so regimented, it takes so much logistics to stage all this stuff that they're giving the gathering companies information on which pad will come online next year in July. So a gathering company that gathers gas and oil and water off the site will know, I've got the following 50 pads to pick up for Oasis in 2015. So that process change and modification is huge. And why can they do that? It has a little bit to do with batch development, but has more importantly to do with the fact that we're no longer drilling to hold leases. In the past, we were drilling to hold leases. So when the lease started to look like it was going to come up, they'd shift the rig to hold the lease if they thought it was significant. Right now, we're doing most of the leases are held. They're going to be that are going to be attempted to be held. There's about 10% lease acquisition that's going on right now, and 90% just plain pad drilling. So the batch process allows for the gatherers to know exactly what's coming on when. Now, the problem with all that is that the poor gatherer now finds out that they're getting 8 wells that are coming on within a one-week period off of a high, in a formation that may have an IP of 3,000 barrels per day, which means that your gas content is going to be just as high. So, and it's going to drop off over time. So a gatherer has to decide, well, how in the heck am I going to size this? And historically, we'd bring in a line that was sized, had extra capacity, and we can always pressurize higher, but there wasn't enough capacity to take on all 8. So there's a lot of, even on existing pads that have gathering systems, you have to go back in and double lay a line to get everything to work. Or in the case of the gatherers again, and they'll have to figure out what they're going to do with this huge surge of gas that's going to go all the way through their system. That's going to drop off because as these pads come on in very remote locations, that bubble has to go through the entire system. So that they're reckoning with that now, deciding, well, how do we handle that? So most importantly is that there's cooperation and planning that goes on where a driller won't go in and frack and develop and bring online 10 of these on the same gathering system. They'll bring one online in the same gathering system over here, try to stage it so that they can do a better job of gathering it all. So it's getting better. The whole batch development process is getting better. And it's forcing planning, which is very important for the industry. And that's the next one, and I just went over it, adequately sized gathering systems. We're getting them. They're coming online fast, but when you're trying to pick up new wells and you're trying to double lay existing lines and you're trying to boost the horsepower at your compressor station so you can force more through the same systems, it's all adding to infrastructure. So we can move more gas, it's just we need more horsepower. Well, if we need more horsepower, we need more power. And we're going to have power is an issue, and power will continue to be an issue because as the system continues to grow to reach its higher levels of capacity, more and more power is going to be required. We're finally developing reliable systems to move the product, and in the next 5-year period, we'll see these reliable systems come online. And I keep referring to the three big E's in our industries. It's enterprise, Energy Transfer Partners, and Enbridge. And those three big E's, each one of them has a $3 to $5 billion project that they're looking at providing for North Dakota to get our oil someplace. Energy Products into Chicago, Enbridge over into the Minnesota and South markets, and Enterprise down into Cushing. So major systems that will go online, give us more reliable ways to get the product to market, but more importantly, increase the cost or the price that we're able to pay the, at the wellhead. So to ship on a pipeline to a market will be $5 to $7. To ship with the multiple moves that are required on rail will be $12 to $15. So it's a significant adjustment in the actual costs that come online overall. And then the fields are consolidating. And so fields can consolidate in two ways. Producers can all decide that there's going to be a single operator, which is happening a lot. So they say, well, Marathon operates most of the wells in this field, and there's a bunch of the rest of us that have one or two. Let's just give it to Marathon to run them all. So they're reaching these deals. And the second way that consolidation occurs is that Whiting comes in and buys Kodiak, which is two major companies, and when they combine, even more major. But when they combine their knowledge, their operations increases, and it becomes much better. So it may not be a true technology change, but it is because they bring each other's technologies into the field and they operate more efficiently. And then we are in the entry stages of automation, and through the five-year period, automation would go online to become more and more important as we can't find the people to do the jobs we need to do. On the environmental side, what do we see that could affect infrastructure demand, production-size infrastructure demand? Primarily today, it's other states, it's border states regulations that are going to affect us. And we're seeing the first round of that with the Enterprise, with the Enbridge project in Minnesota, where Minnesota now came back and said, nope, you got to go back and do a lot more analysis. So Minnesota's saying, we're going to change our regulations to do higher levels of enforcement. That's going to affect us in the fact that we won't be able to move our pipelines across the state very quickly. South Dakota's going to have two major siting permits that are going to come into their hands at the same time. South Dakota's not very experienced with major siting, so we'll see how that all goes. So they may make adjustments. And Montana is a state that you just stay the heck out of. They adjusted their major siting law in 2012 so that you have to study 3 1-mile wide corridors for any pipeline, and it's impossible to study 3 1-mile wide corridors and make a project go. So already Montana has basically said pipelines can't go through our state. So for us, that's capped off our western edge, so we need to make sure that South Dakota stays friendly. Tribal regulations and development requirements. And I don't know what can happen on the three affiliated lands, but I do know that it's tumultuous to develop up there and that they control 33% of our production. So any further adjustments or changes or requirements could have impacts. Flaring regulations, and I know that we don't see any changes, but we're just pointing out that these things could affect infrastructure in a big way. What happens with flaring? And then the real outlier that we're starting to see is local regulation of crude oil trains. And didn't think that was even possible. But if local regulation starts prohibiting the trains with Bakken crude from moving through their cities, we could have issues with getting our product to market because you can't move crude on the rail without going through cities. So again, these are just things that to be pointed out that could affect infrastructure demand. Policy issues. Some of these are pretty good. Crude export rules could change. It does look strongly like there is a possibility that in the next 5 years we'll be allowed to export light sweet crudes. That would be significant for us because the international refiners are looking for a lot of light sweet crudes, and when we don't have the capacity, we could maybe reach a deal where we trade or something. So there's a number of things in place that suggest that crude export could occur. There's a lot of indications that there'll be tightening crude supplies in areas of international conflict. And if that occurs, those types of circumstances could drive the potential for crude exports. Some of our better partners in the international levels can't get their crude supplies from their traditional locations, which may allow our country to have exports happen. And then the big outlier that, of course, comes up all the time, and I'm just pointing out, I don't have any feeling one way or the other. Well, I have a feeling, but can't say that. Federal regulators could make the depletion allowance changes that they keep suggesting at the tax policy level. Those depletion allowances are extremely important to make the field profitable, and by the way, our profitability analysis show those. They include the depletion allowance in the profitability analysis. So some base assumption for infrastructure needs. 2013-2014 looks to be the norm in the oil patch. That's the level of construction. That's the level of infrastructure growth. That's the level of activity that's necessary to keep the field growing at the pace that it is. The next assumption is a huge one, and that is that the infrastructure deteriorates when used at design standards. Most infrastructure that we design as engineers never sees design standards. We design for a certain number of trucks and we never achieve that level of trucks. We design for certain levels of traffic and we never see it. That's not the case in the Bakken. Whatever level we design for, it's achieved quickly, which means that the infrastructure deteriorates. So ongoing costs are going to be higher. O&M costs are going to be higher for the level of infrastructure that we have to build in a factory environment, the production environment. And the good news on the opposite side of that is we're increasing our infrastructure inventory. We will never again have to four-lane Highway 85. It's a big endeavor. It'll be done in 3 years or four. It'll be a major change to the system in the West, and we'll never have to do it again. We may have to make some improvements to it, but we won't have to do it. We're adding the same level of infrastructure with passing lanes and with bypasses around communities and all those things. So we're doing the right thing. We're putting infrastructure in inventory that can then be used to make oil development in our state positive and easier to do. So I'm just, again, pointing out some things that we believe have some issues. Rail, I made an incorrect statement at one of our meetings, and I said I thought rail could recover fast enough. I was dead wrong. Rail can't recover as fast as we need them to recover. They can't get the power they need, which is the locomotives. They can't find the people they need. And more importantly, they can't double track fast enough. They will, and they are, but it's going to be an issue for us across the board. They're trying to recover as fast as they can, but we still see train shortages everywhere. Pipelines and storage. And pipelines, I mean major export pipelines. There's a number of open seasons going on right now for the pipelines that we talked about, the three E's. And storage is still low. Operational hubs, and that's simply places where people can build their infrastructure, house their parts, get everything ready to go. And then probably the largest infrastructure need at the private level is power. Power meaning electricity, and can we keep up? I mean, when we did the power study 2 years ago, we said there'd be 4 to 6 wells per pad, and now we're saying there could be 24 to 36. That's a substantial difference in load. And when you put that kind of load on a pad, it also flows through the entire system because it takes more power to push the product to the end market. And I know that the industry is reacting to it, and it's just an industry need that's there. So public infrastructure. And I'm just going to use this as an example so you can see the type of dollars that need to be committed to make things work. Williston is going to require 16,000 housing units in the study period. That means that there's about almost $500 million in subdivision infrastructure. That's the local water and sewer. That's the road systems, curbs and gutters. Then there's another $200 million that generally needs to be contributed from other sources or combined sources. That's stormwater systems, major road collector systems, all the things that generally are provided by cities. And then there's the other intangibles, what the water and wastewater capacities will increase and those types of things. So significant infrastructure requirements for communities like Williston that will grow at these very, very high growth rates. Dickinson. 10,000 units, $300 million in subdivision infrastructure costs alone, plus the other costs that are the same proportions and ratios, might add about $180 million to pull together the costs. So the public infrastructure at their levels are going to be very strong and very much in demand. So the thoughts slash recommendations are, first of all, funding levels for infrastructures will remain, actually that's not worded correctly, I'm sorry. Funding requirements for infrastructure will remain constant over the next 5-year period. Where the funding comes from, that's up to you. but the demands for that infrastructure funding will not deteriorate. We have too many systems that need to be kept up. infrastructure demands in the field, meaning the local county roads and the county infrastructure, will be more focused on those red areas. So we'll find more need for better access. It'll help planners decide which roads should be paved and which can be left as gravel, and they'll go from there. I think the biggest one is there's a significant need for O&M funding. And the reason is because all these communities in the West have been forced to take every dime they have and devote it towards new infrastructure. So when they have a lift station that probably was shot before the boom, well, they're just piecing it together with duct tape now because they don't have any money. They can't fix it. Now, we're 4 or 5 years into some of this infrastructure, and the infrastructure that was placed 4 or 5 years ago in the initial stages of this boom was not the best built infrastructure. So we're starting to see this stuff deteriorate, and no money for O&M. So they can't find operators internally. They don't have the money for maintenance because they're diverting it towards new infrastructure, and it's going to come back to hurt us because deferred maintenance funding is a very poor strategy to follow. And the infrastructure needs are going to evolve, of course, and I'm just say that quickly to say we're not building Highway 85 again. It'll be four-lane, it'll work perfect, but we have plenty of other transportation infrastructure needs that need to go on. And the last one is extremely important also, is that social infrastructure must be strongly supported or we won't achieve our labor goals. And we have, at KLGI, have currently about 120 openings for people that I can't fill the jobs. So we recruit everywhere, we can recruit into some of our offices, but we sure can't recruit into the West. Well, I need people in the West, and it's very difficult to recruit in. The greatest issues we have is that they just don't have the right social infrastructure to make it strong enough to bring families in. So social infrastructure is the only thing that will support the type of job and employment growth that we need. And that concludes the formal presentation. Glad to take questions.
Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Niles, would you elaborate just a little bit on the basic factors that you consider that would make up social infrastructure? Talking about, you know, education, daycare, what goes in there?
Senator Murphy, yes, I believe strongly that it's all of those. It's education, it's daycare. Social infrastructure to me is affordable housing. It's school systems that can handle the diverse type of employee that we might bring in with different type of language requirements. It's the mental health systems that are in place to try to treat those. It's the health systems then that come along. So in our case, again, it is definitely the daycare situation and how that handles. And then it's the little things, like we get constant scoldings from our employees because air travel's too expensive, so they can't fly back to see their families. Now, I know we can't control air travel, but it's still a social issue that compounds our ability to attract and attain and retain the workforce that we're going to need to drive this production forward the next 5 years.
Senator Andrews, did you have a question?
Mr. Chairman and Niles, do you see any sense for, are we going to see a growing clamor for some kind of new rail construction to bypass the high population areas?
And Senator Andrews, it is interesting that you bring that up because we are working on one project for a community that's looking at bypassing. First time I've seen it in this region, and it's actually shared in Wyoming, who is trying to build a bypass around. And the costs are so phenomenal that after looking at that one, I don't believe it's possible. And Sheridan only has about 12 miles of trackage that they'll have to bypass, but they'll also have to rebuild the rail yards. And so the total combined costs are in the 30, 40 million range just for the simplest project. So I believe that even if there is a clamor for that, with all the infrastructure that the railroad laid into our communities, the switching yards, the fueling stations, all of those things, it will be very difficult for it to be achieved. So I suspect in the rail side, what will happen is that the move towards safer rail cars, and then the control of the product placed in the car, which is which can be done at the loading sites, should reduce the amount of potential danger that occurs as these cars go through. And then the other thing that I think the railroad is doing is that it's going into these communities and it's strengthening, doing a better job of maintaining the track systems in the communities so that those particular track systems are just beefed up well enough that for any type of fault to occur is a lot stronger, a lot weaker than it would be. So I think that's the solutions that they'll be following. It's just rebuilding in the right way with higher level of infrastructure.
Okay, anyone else? Representative Sebenhagen?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hushka, at our last presentation that you did, I think you talked a little bit about capital, outside capital moving in, and earlier there had been some restrictions there and it was moving more freely. Do you anticipate that to be the case over the course of the next 5 years, that adequate capital is going to be available, outside capital?
Representative Sebenhagen, yesterday there was a 8-page article that came through in one of our scanning services about capital in the Bakken and how it's changing and where it's coming from, and it reinforced what we talked about last time, saying that even conservative banks are now willing to finance some assets in the Bakken. So they're seeing the potential, which drives a different type of financing, because traditionally in gathering systems and similar facilities it was all risk capital, and now banks are coming online and saying, we'll take a part of that. So we proved ourselves out, and we will continue to as we continue to grow. And so to answer your question straightforward, yes, it's good now, but it'll even get better.
Senator Triplett.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Hushka, the most interesting part of your presentation to me was when you told us that none of your employees who are now living in Williston want to live in Williston 5 years from now or see themselves living in Williston. I think that we should all be really concerned about that. Did you follow up in your conversation with your employees to see, you know, sort of what the reasons were and how that broke down, and would you be willing to share that with us?
Certainly, Senator Triplett. Well, first off, as soon as the hands went up, I made them go around the table and tell me, and then we followed up in addition. And first thing that was common was that they all felt that they'd gone to Williston on a term of duty, and that when their term of duty / tolerance exceeded, they would go home to their families. And so, you know, the fact that only two of the 36 employees in our office had brought their families was a dead sign. That we were in trouble, because that's an indicator for us in the Bakken across the board. If you don't bring your family, you're leaving. So that feeling. And so why is the feeling? And the biggest issue that we had was the costs of living were so high that even if we paid them 25% more, which is what we do in our Williston office, they still didn't feel that they were being compensated correctly. But really the biggest one, no matter how hard we pushed, was simply that their families didn't come to Williston. They came to work in these high-rate environments, and that was the way they assumed they'd be acting. So no other complaints. I mean, they all complimented highly the rec center, and they all complimented highly all the other functions and features, but it still wasn't enough to make them raise their hands.
If I may follow up. I'll just do one more question on this topic, and then I'll move on to something else. Did you inquire of them what it would take to make them bring their families, or are they just people who truly don't want to live in North Dakota?
Senator Triplett, the vast majority were just simply people who had no intentions of moving and still don't. They mean their families were the wrong age. They'd have kids in high school, or they had a spouse that had a very good job wherever they lived. So there was no move with intention when they came to work for us in our those offices.
Okay. Thank you. And then if I may continue.
You may continue.
You used the word we a number of times, and I'm assuming when you say we, you're sort of talking about the industry in general, but I just want to clarify. At one point you said, and I think this is close to a quote, we still do not know exactly how the fracking is working, but there will be significant development in the next 5 years. Do you think it's the case that the oil industry still doesn't quite know how far they're reaching on a frack job, or is it just that you at KLJ don't know because they haven't told you?
Senator Tripp, I believe that it's a combination of both. First, in the oil and gas industry, any discovery is viewed as secret, so knowledge isn't shared rapidly. So it takes a while for those knowledge streams to flow through different entities, and the way knowledge streams flow through the industries in the oil fields is by trading employees. So this employee churn that we see is actually good. So we learn more from employee churn than we learn from anything else. So I think that's first. And second, yes, I would say we haven't learned what's going on. I would say certain companies are very familiar, much better than others. So the industry as a whole hasn't gained that as knowledge base.
And then I guess the follow-up to that is, do you think that the oil companies, or at least the most of them, are the ones who are doing the largest amount of drilling, are providing adequate information to state agencies to enable us as a group, state government as an entity, to make good decisions about where infrastructure should go? I mean, you mentioned specifically that it was just a few years ago when you did your electricity study for Basin that you were estimating 4 to 6 wells per pad as the max, and now we're talking, you said 24. I mean, there are some cases where I think there's going to be up to 36 that are already being licensed, you know, 2 pads on a spacing unit, each of which have 18. Mm-hmm. And so it seems to me that there must have been some inkling 3 years ago when you did your electricity study inside the industry that they were going that direction, at least in those areas inside your red line, and yet it wasn't communicated to state government in a way that would have allowed state government to do appropriate planning. And so I guess the question now is, do you think that that has improved at some level so that the Industrial Commission, the Health Department, the Department of Mineral Resources are getting the right kind of information to be able to come to the legislature and tell us what the infrastructure needs will be? Or do you think we still have to push to get better access to information?
Senator Tripp, I'll start that, you know, a little ways back and say that I do strongly believe that no one 2 years ago believed that we would be placing more than 4 to 6 wells on a pad. I mean, the field was it was in those levels of infancy and development. So there may have been some inclinations in the back halls of Continental, but they certainly weren't going to tell us, because that would have been us. They believed they were at that stage had a significant advantage to tie up as much property as they could in those particular fields. So at the time, that was the best that was available. Very few, if any, had any belief that there would be three-dimensional harvesting of the field. And so the knowledge base gained and the technologies improved, and that's where we are. So even if we would have had any different reporting requirements, I don't know if we would have seen it or heard anything different. Now I feel much better today because the field is mature enough. We have a very good sense for what's going on. The sensor technologies are improved. The downhole sensors are way better. Everything is advancing at a rapid pace. And so now we have a much better overall comprehensive field for what's going to go on and what is going on. And so I do believe finally we can start to do some real planning. Up until this last breakthrough with the multi-pad technologies, we were all acting under a veil of incorrect information.
All right. Representative Schatz.
Hey, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hushka, I was on the environmental page. It talks about tribal regulations and developments. And if 33% of the production comes out of the Fort Berthold Reservation, is that correct? I think that was the number you used. And then what are the problems that you're dealing with as far as the tribal regulations? And is there anything that the legislature can do to, you know, help improve that business environment at all?
Representative Schatz, I'll do my best to answer that. It's on, I am with examples. That's probably the best way that I can do it.
Sure.
So we normally serve the oil fields with overhead power lines for two reasons. First of all, because you can put more voltage in an overhead power line and get the right amount of heat dissipation so that your losses are acceptable, and so you can move power back and forth. So the reservation has decided that they no longer will allow overhead power lines, and that you need to bury power lines. And we can bury a service line to a home or to a pad, but to bury a 46,000-volt line in the ground means that not only do you have to bury a very large line, but then you have to double jacket it and oftentimes cool it so that you can get the power to move in an effective way. But it doesn't matter. It's not efficient and effective. So that little adjustment has meant that there's significant issues with power on the reservation, and right now a large segment of reservation wells in certain remote locations are being powered by gen sets. Generators powering well pads are not an effective means in the short term or long term, because you get power spikes, which takes out all the sensitive equipment, so it makes the field unreliable. So that's an example. We have long permit approval times that are coming through, that are being held up basically by permittees inside of the tribe itself. The federal side will say it looks good, but it still has to move through the very intricate networks of the tribe itself. So, and then insecurity / uncertainty. Do you hold a lease? Do you not hold a lease? Those types of things which are driving drillers crazy. So. And then the last one, it's just all about relationships, is the best I can say. And so if the companies don't have and don't maintain the right relationships, they just have a very difficult time on working on the tribal lands.
Senator Andrist.
Growth projection. I'm rather surprised to see that your projections are surprisingly flat. They don't match the production projections. For instance, you see in Divide and Bowman at the extremes, ends of the Bakken, you're projecting about the same population growth as you are for in the center, Williams and McKenzie. Can you tell us anything about why that is?
Can I ask Dean to come up and tell you? Would you mind, Dean?
No, problem.
It would be a great help to me.
Committee and Senator Andrist, the population modeling is based on first looking at regional employment, and then looking at the distribution of the housing units within that region, and looking at the mobility of the workforce. And so there is some regionality that's incorporated in those county numbers. And Bowman has served that southwest corner as a regional trade center. So when you see regional growth in secondary businesses and additional job growth that feeds the industry, some of that is going to occur through the trade center of Bowman. And so the population growth that's occurring out there is not driven entirely by oil and gas employment. It's driven by other factors as well.
Would you state your name for the record?
I'm sorry. My name is Dean Bankson. I'm a research scientist in the Department of Agribusiness and Applied Economics at North Dakota State University.
Thank you. Did you get your question answered then?
You will.
All right. All right, Senator Triplett.
If I could just follow up with Dean on that same potential growth. Population growth potential chart that Senator Andrews just referred to, there's a sort of little footnote off on the side that says growth forecast does not include restrictions. Can you just tell us what you mean by that phrase?
Well, the terminology that we're using with the word potential is that we can't determine if, in fact, those communities will be able to add all the housing units they need. Okay, if, in fact, a lot of those housing units do not get built, and a lot of these workers cannot or will not bring families, those adjustments would affect the population because you don't have the accompanying adults to go with it. Those are certain factors that we can't control. And so what the modeling does is it It looks at the change in growth of employment in the industries and then says, what is the need to service that size of workforce? And if those infrastructures do not get built, then of course we might not achieve those population numbers.
Okay. Anyone else have any questions for Dean while he's here? Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Any questions, comments on the report? I think you're done.
No, thank you.
I appreciate you coming in. This man had to go home. Someone had to take him home. He was sick yesterday, and he has sucked it up.
Going home now, too.
Well, that's a good idea. I was dumb enough to overdo it on Saturday, and I went back, so I wasn't very functional on Sunday. So I understand. All right, committee members, is there anyone from the public that would like to make any comments about this report? If not, we do have to have a motion on it. But before we do, I just want to say that Senator Triplett, the one question you asked about the information gathering for the legislature, I will have to tell you that early, you know, last session, there was stuff going on out there that I had no idea, and I live out there. And I just want to say that I appreciate the fact that you brought this study forward, because this is one way that we have been able to communicate and find out what's going on out there. So this report and this study gives us a lot better picture for the legislature going forward, so we can see what we're going to have to deal with. So I just want to publicly thank you for pushing the issue and getting this in here, because it is no question. It's and we're having a press conference in a little bit, and we could almost haul Niles down there, and he would be able to. We're not going to, but I mean, this backs up everything that we're going to be talking about. So with that, I need a motion to, what is it? To accept this, and it will then go to legislative management. All right, the motion was made by Representative Schatz to accept, seconded by Senator Triplett. Any discussion? Senator Triplett.
Before Niles and his crew leaves, I just want to say thanks to them for the respectful way in which they have handled this process and the quality of the final product that has been produced. I think we got off to a little bit of a rocky start when we were trying to decide what it was we wanted out of this report, but I think it has come together very well, and I'm pleased to see it. And I just wanted to say publicly that I appreciate the work that you all have done and the way that you have handled the issues and the way that you have reported it out today. So my thanks.
I would agree with that. I've learned things that I didn't know I had to learn, but it's very exciting, all the information you've brought to us. So thank you very much. If there's no comments or any discussion, council will take the roll.
Senators Wardner.
Aye.
Andrist.
Aye.
Armstrong.
Aye.
Hoag. Murphy.
Aye.
Triplett.
Aye.
Representatives Porter.
Yes.
Bowe. Damshin. Hansen.
Yes.
Schatz.
Yes.
Silbernagel.
Yes.
Okay, it passes. The report will be moved on to legislative management. At this time, we'll move to the 11:35 a.m. agenda on our item, and we'll have Mr. Dawson talk about the bill draft to increase the funding to the abandoned oil and gas well plugging and site reclamation fund. So with that, if you would, I would like to decide whether we're moving it or not moving it. We're not going to sit on it any longer.
Chairman Wardner, committee members, this is the third time this bill draft has been brought up before you. This one increases the funding for the abandoned oil and gas well plugging and site reclamation fund. Because of the effective dates involved, the changes are made on pages 2 and 6 and are exactly the same. And so if you look on page 2 at the top, you will see that the cap is raised from $5 to $10 million per year and from $70 to $100 million total.
Okay, committee members, I would like a motion on the draft to Silbernagle. Is that moved to adopt, okay, and seconded by Representative Hansen. Okay, discussion. Senator Triplett.
Mr. Chairman, I'm in favor of increasing the amount, and I applaud Representative Porter for bringing this issue forward. I don't think the dollar amount is enough, but I have made some effort to communicate with people to try to figure out what the appropriate dollar amount is, and I haven't figured it out yet. So I think I'm just going to let it go for now, and obviously we have the opportunity during the session to make changes and to suggest higher numbers. I think there is enough abandoned situations out there that need attention that this is still too small of a number, but this certainly provides us a vehicle to take testimony and find what the right number is in the session. So with that, I would just say that I'll vote for it, but I do think it needs to be higher in the end.
Before we vote, we will have anybody in the audience at hand wants to make comments about it, but we do have a vehicle, and you're right, when it gets into the legislative session, amendment, all this stuff can be amended up or down or whatever. So, any other comments? Any other discussion? At this time, I invite anybody to make any comments from the audience on the bill draft. Well, if not, council will take the roll.
On LC number 113.01, Senators Wardner.
Aye.
Andrist.
Aye.
Armstrong.
Aye.
Hoag. Murphy.
Aye.
Triplett.
Aye.
Representatives Porter.
Yes.
Bow. Damshin. Hansen.
Yes.
Schatz.
Yes.
Silbernagle.
Yes.
Well, committee, I think we're going to do the 1 o'clock one, and if it would run past 11:50, we would stop. If not, we're going to do one more bill if we can to lighten our load in the afternoon. So we're going to do the 1 p.m. Bill.
Senator Wardner, Chairman Wardner, committee members, the bill draft before you is 114. It's the third time it has been presented. Just like the previous one, the bill takes the oil and gas production tax up to $75 million per biennium and places it in the highway fund for certain oil-impacted projects like Highway 85. The main need of it, you can see how it is spent. The money that is put into the highway fund is in subsection 4 on page 2. It is used for major improvements and construction of highway corridors impacted by energy development with a priority for 4 lanes for United States Highway 85. The monies are not subject to rollover.
Committee members, entertain a motion. Representative Porter.
I would move approval.
We have a motion to approve, seconded by Senator Armstrong. Any discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Porter.
This idea came forward after we had significant discussion on highway infrastructure out in western North Dakota, particularly major major routing, and the method that we're using here is very similar to what we do with water projects and what we've done in the past with water projects, where we say that the project is a good project, but it's very expensive. We're waiting for federal approval. We're waiting for other components. Maybe even the EIS isn't completed or is partially completed, or it ends up in court. But we still have that money in the bank, setting aside, ready to go for the project, so that we aren't coming from behind and then saying, geez, I wish we would have saved that money and been able to do the project. And I think we all, after seeing the report from KLJ, understand that the significant need out in western North Dakota is certainly going to be from Watford City to Belfield with Highway 85 in the very near future. And I think this is just prudent to start banking some money so that when the project is ready to go and when it's up and ready to go, that we've got the pool of money to do it with.
Okay. Anyone else on the committee want to make a comment? Senator Triplett.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't like the way we do water projects that way either, so I intend to vote no against this, just because I don't think it's really appropriate for us to be pulling one project out and putting it under a different kind of process. I think, you know, that our Department of Transportation has well-developed policies and procedures. I mean, I think they certainly understand the Highway 85 issues and take it very seriously and have worked very diligently toward getting the first section of it four-lane. I have no doubt that they will continue to work on the rest of it, but I just don't think that the legislature, you know, after having defined agencies and given them roles and responsibilities, should then go back and micromanage and say, but this one is the most important. I have thought it inappropriate that we do water projects that way. Again, we have a state water commission that's sort of tasked with that, and I think if we're going to set sort of, you know, if it's a legislature, we're going to be setting broad policies and then leaving the execution of those policies to our state agencies, that we should be consistent about it. So it's not an anti-85 kind of argument. It's just a statement that I don't think it's the right way to do policy. So that's going to be my reason to vote against it.
All right, thank you.
Chairman, just to kind of expound on Senator Triplett's comments, if that were really the case, then Highway 2 would still be a two-lane, because that was a legislative priority construction project that the DOT back in the day said wasn't needed. And the legislature chose differently and made that from Minot to Williston a four-lane, and it's certainly showed that inside of those agencies, they don't always see what we see when we're living in our districts. I think the same case in point back to the Water Commission goes to the Western Area Water Project, that they didn't necessarily think that was a very good idea, that we prioritize that project and put all the funds into that, and now we're seeing the benefits of that type of project also. So I do see that there is a limited benefit to doing these projects every once in a while, that we see from being close to the people what works, and I don't necessarily think that we should be cherry picking all the projects across the state, but there certainly is in those impacted areas a need for this type of work.
If I may just respond.
You may.
Okay. I think the Western Area Water Supply Project is something that we could argue about for quite a few hours, and we have in the legislature, as you well know, so I'm not going to get into it here, but I think, you know, I have a different perception of why the Water Commission didn't perceive it as a priority or didn't want to take it on than you do, and so I think I'll just leave it at that. But I appreciate, again, the need for a water project in Western North Dakota, and I think, I mean, I have been vocal along the way about objecting to how it has been done. So I think I'm being consistent, and you're being consistent, and we just disagree. So.
Well, there's no question that because of the way things have happened out there has made us do things that we don't normally do that way. It's been forced in some ways. Anyone else on the committee? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to make comments about this particular piece of legislation? If not, we're going to have council call the roll.
On Bill LC number 114.01, Senators Wardner.
Aye.
Andrist.
Aye.
Armstrong.
Aye.
Hoag. Murphy.
Aye.
Triplett.
No.
Representatives Porter.
Yes.
Bode. Damschen. Hansen.
Yes.
Schatz.
Aye.
Silbernagle.
Yes.
Okay, the motion passes. This bill will be forwarded on. Committee members, we're going to break for lunch. We will start with the 1:10 p.m. Item on the agenda when we return at 1 o'clock. And until then, we're in recess. October. It's in beautiful Grand Forks. It's always beautiful in October in Grand Forks. It's the day every time I'm there in fall, it's the box elder bugs are out, and it's just great. And so, is there anything that you want council to take care of for the next meeting? All right. If not, thank you for your help, Senator Triplett.
Mr. Chairman, just as a follow-up on the conversation that we've had about the Empower process, I guess I would just like there maybe to be some discussion at the committee chair level or at legislative management level or something, which I'm obviously not part of, about this process and maybe suggest some improvements for next time around, that if we're going to be actually approving these bills, that we would be given, you know, a packet of information at least on who appeared and that sort of thing, the testimony, or that we, in 2 years from now, that this committee would consider taking, limited amount of testimony or something, just to somehow the process be improved one way or the other for the next interim. Because I think it is a slightly flawed process the way we...
I hear you, and I can see where there could be some issues. We could have a bill slipped in that's by doing it this way. But however, I'm comfortable with these. But we are not hearing the testimony. And this year there just happens to be a lot of bills, and it's all of a sudden you see the what could happen. All right, anything else? I will definitely tell legislative management when we meet on that. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, on the same lines, I guess, knowing that they do go through a process in committees, maybe if we're looking for the input and the files and everything, the agency should be providing us the same thing when they put an agency bill in.
The difference, Mr. Chairman, is that the agency bills don't have the stamp of approval of any of the interim committees. And they're coming in straight to the legislature as agency bills without any interim committee having said, we approve it. And we are here sitting there approving it. And I just want to say, you know, out loud to anybody who from Empower who might still be in the room, that this is, you know, my concerns are from at a policy level. I don't have any axe to grind with the Empower Commission or the work that they did. I know they put an enormous amount of time and energy and resources into it, and I appreciate the work that they have done. I just think that, I mean, they are not a legislature, and we don't expect them to be a mini legislature, and their processes just by nature, I think, don't attract the level of attention that the legislative process does, and it doesn't bring the opposition out, you know, so people who may have legitimate concerns may simply not be aware of what has gone on. And so I just think that the process needs a little bit of tweaking before next time around. So I appreciate your offer to carry that out.
We'll discuss it. We've been so happy with it because it used to be that the industries came in and they had a fist fight in the legislature. And our chairman would tell them to go out and figure it out, and sometimes they did and sometimes they didn't. But all I can say is that overall, from the time it started until now, it's been good for the state of North Dakota because the empower people have moved the agenda. And I mentioned this before, that there are some issues from different renewable and non-renewable areas where they would never cooperate on anything. And all of a sudden you find these two competitive groups working together. So it's been good for the state of North Dakota. And yes, I think we just need to take a look at this to make sure we aren't doing something we don't want to. But I would say I agree. We need to understand that the empowerment thing has been very beneficial to the state of North Dakota. I'm sorry you guys are a little late. We're done. Perfect timing. But we moved ahead of schedule and it worked out fine. So I think your issue is we've ruled the way you would have wanted us to do. All right, anything else for the good of the order? If not, I'd call for a motion to adjourn. Is there a second? Okay, we got a motion and a second to adjourn. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. We're adjourned.
Yeah.